Hello?
Yes.
Yes, J.J. Goldberg, yeah, good morning.
Good morning.
Yeah, so can you hear me?
I hear you fine. Do you hear me?
Okay, yes, wonderful.
Good.
Okay, great.
So what's up?
Yeah, thank you so much for joining us with an interview. My center, the Berlin International Center for the Study of Anti-Semitism, BICSA, is just starting a series of interviews and debates with outstanding journalists or scholars and activists, and you are the first in this year, 2017. So we are happy and glad to have you with us. My first question would be, because based on your really interesting CV online, your biography, what about the Radical Zionist Alliance? You have once been a member or an activist.
That dissipated many years ago. It was a student event. In the early 70s, the New Left in America disappeared, and the Radical Zionist Alliance disappeared with it. The people who were involved went on, some joined kibbutzim, some went into community organizing and labor, and others just got degrees and became journalists and business people and so on.
I see. Because usually most people don't want to be associated with anything called a radical. So what was the idea of having a radical Zionist alliance and not just a whatever left?
In 1970, radical was a very good thing for students.
Okay, I see. Yeah.
I mean, nowadays it's considered a bad word, but back then it was very much in fashion. Radicals, people who called themselves radicals, were the leaders of their student of the student bodies on campus.
Okay, no, that's fine. I mean, I myself was just called by a leading conservative American NGO activist from Philadelphia, a radical. So, and that was not positive. So I was kind of.
Was that Mort Twain?
That was from the Middle East Forum in Philadelphia, and they were not really.
Daniel Pipes.
Yes, yeah, and we had a kind of discussion which will lead us actually to Trump and all the other things involved. Now we had a discussion about refugees and racism in Germany, and we came across a graffiti in Berlin in a neighborhood where there was written Angela Merkel is Mother Teresa. And so I was in a way defending the conservative Angela Merkel, German chancellor, and saying, well, I mean, these people obviously are fleeing jihad and state terrorism in Syria. Mm-hmm. And of course, we know there might be and there will be. And unfortunately, there have been some jihadists infiltrated in these refugees. But most of these, we're talking about hundreds of thousands or a million refugees, of course, are fleeing a horrible situation. And what I was kind of astonished that I was framed radical, because I was saying, well, I mean, these people deserve support. And if we consider what happened in history, take the Jewish refugees in the 30s without equating or comparing the situation, but at least have a slight idea what means if you are rejected at the border. I mean, many Jews coming from Germany have been rejected at the border and they didn't get a visa for America. You know, so perhaps you know these kind of discussions that people today are called radical if they say, well, a refugee is still a human being and might be as good or as bad as other people, in my view.
It's a fairly small group on the radical right that would call your position radical. Most Americans, even conservatives, who don't favor admitting refugees, still don't think that the favoring of refugees is radical. They understand there's sort of two positions and it cuts down the middle of American society. And further toward the edge, the people look at the other side as being kind of illegitimate and radical, out of the mainstream. But most people near the center, I think, regard the other side as wrong, but not radical.
Okay.
He's a very sharp-tongued, I don't know if he's, within his world, he's a moderate. He doesn't believe that all Muslims are evil.
Right. That was my point of departure. Yeah, exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
But he's very certain that he's right and that people who disagree with him are just completely out of line.
That's right.
That's why you can use a phrase like that.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the strange story is he didn't even vote for Trump. Actually, he put a pic on Facebook or Twitter that he did not vote for him. Then, of course, all his followers they screamed out and they called him a traitor and whatever. And I'm not 100% sure if he didn't want a Trump or it just was a kind of personal distaste, because he definitely doesn't like behavior of Trump. But
people don't like Trump because it's not any particular thing he believes in, because he doesn't really believe in anything.
Yeah,
it's that he's unstable, that he doesn't learn situations before he makes decisions. He's impulsive. He's got very little impulse control. He doesn't listen to people. So that it's not that somebody would disagree with the decisions he will make. They are frightened of the way he operates and the possibility that he could say something without considering it and start a war by accident, meaning to, but because he's thoughtless. And that has nothing to do with refugees or Muslims. Nothing to do with it.
Yeah, sure, absolutely. So would you agree that the election of Trump and some reactions in the Jewish and Israeli communities can be considered an earthquake, as French-Israeli Eva Illouz has framed it in Haaretz?
The election of Trump is probably an earthquake, yes. Bearing in mind that he lost the vote by a considerable margin.
Yes, 3 million almost.
He was badly
almost
beaten, but because of the electoral system. So it's an earthquake in the sense of who will become the president. I don't know that it teaches us very much about the American public, other than its thoughtlessness, but we knew about that. The response of the Jewish community doesn't surprise me at all. Bear in mind, most of the Jews voted against Trump.
Yes.
The vast majority. So he only got 25% of the Jewish vote. The people who speak for the Jews in America, all those organizations that run around Washington, their main priority is to get along with the administration. They are primarily concerned with defending what they consider defending Israel.
Yes.
Protecting the Israeli government from any consequences of its decisions. And so it's more important to them to have access to the White House and the State Department than any other consideration of American social society. They're not very interested in American society.
Okay,
now, that's not universally true. There's some that the Anti-Defamation League, for example, it takes a pretty conservative stance on Israel, but it is also very outspoken in defending gay rights, civil racial justice, and so on. So they're it's to generalize and say they don't care about American society goes too far.
Yeah, I mean, if you recall the initial response by the ADL after the election, for example, Jonathan Greenblatt, he was kind of definitely shocked. I mean, I saw several events with him radiotaped or videotaped. But in recent weeks, and you are much closer to the situation in New York, in America in general, I thought there might be a little step back from the ADL, from their criticism of the Trump administration in recent weeks, due to perhaps substantial criticism of the ADL by the American Zionist Organization, by the Simon Wiesenthal Center, or by even intellectuals and scholars like Alvin Rosenfeld. I was astonished because I know Alvin Rosenfeld, who is a scholar in Holocaust studies and a famous intellectual from Bloomington, Indiana. And I was astonished having seen him quoted to say, well, the ADL should be quiet about Trump in the first place. So do you see any change already in the ADL's position towards a more, let's say, reluctant way to criticize the Trump administration?
Well, let's start out with this. Alvin Rosenfeld is a tendentious right winger. He may be a good scholar, but he resembles Daniel Pipes in the degree to which he slanders is too strong. He dismisses anybody who disagrees with him as being anti-Semitic or anti-Israel. He's written books that describe friends of mine as anti-Israel because they criticize the Israeli government. There are people who are anti-Israel, including some of the people that he criticizes. He's not always wrong. But he looks at the world through a fairly narrow right-wing perspective. As far as the Simon Wiesenthal Center and the Zionist Organization of America, the ZOA, the ADL is not going to take them seriously. Nobody in the center, in the mainstream, is particularly interested in what they have to say because they're not – the Simon Wiesenthal Center has influence in Los Angeles, but it's not really taken seriously in the rest of the country.
Okay.
The ADL is under pressure from two things. One, their donors. That has when an organizational leader starts changing his view or reverses himself, it's usually because of the donors. But the second thing is, as I said before, once he's the president, what good does it do you to say he's a terrible person? How are you going to do? He's got a $50-60 million budget, Jonathan Greenblatt. He's got to get things done. If he's an enemy of the government, he can't get anything done. So it's all well and good to sound off all this moral talk, but you can't make the world better by posturing in a kind of a moral fashion and not reading the real world.
Yeah, and so do you think there won't be any kind of public protests against Trump and his administration after January 20th? As we have seen...
Oh, there'll be non-stop protests. There'll be enormous protests. Many people are more... Look, what good would the protests do? What difference would it make?
Yeah.
Answer me that. Answer.
No, I mean, of course, a protest is, I mean, if you don't have any access to power and there's no election coming soon, I mean, of course, in a democracy, there's not really a way to change an administration. You can, of course, change, and that is important. The climate, the political climate, the political culture in the country, of course, depends on what people do and say, despite they are powerless if you are not in charge of a government. But still,
In a divided country, the demonstrations by the powerless and by the left only anger the broad public. The Occupy Wall Street movement, what is it, 3 or 4 years ago, it backfired. It alienated because it tends to be represented by people with dreadlocks and drum circles, and people in Kansas are not going to be moved by that.
Yeah.
They're only going to be alienated. It'll show them that this has nothing to do with them.
No, that's
and
right.
And that's who's going to demonstrate. There will be thousands of people demonstrating against Trump. There are smaller Jewish organizations that are planning demonstrations against Trump. But, you know, they're mostly like new organizations that came into existence after 1980 or so. That take a kind of a more principled, if you want, position and don't really have that much influence. They will get thousands of people, mostly young people, into the streets. But it's the majority. I mean, the question is, what do you want to accomplish?
Yeah, sure.
In my opinion, there's many people who confuse politics and self-expression.
Yeah.
Even the people who voted for Jill Stein or Gary Johnson, the third-party candidates, they didn't want to vote for Trump and they didn't want to vote for Hillary, so they expressed their moral values and they got Trump.
Yeah. Now, what I'm wondering is what will happen to the bipartisan pro-Israel stance in America, and will there be a divide, a much wider divide in the American Jewish community, based, for example, on statements by Bibi Netanyahu that the speech by John Kerry, and you covered this on the forward, was shameful or shame, which I think was a kind of strange statement based on your articles on the United Nations Security Council resolution, which was definitely a pro-Israel resolution, but of course not very positive to the settlements. But
write that Kerry's speech was shameful. I don't know who did.
No, Bibi cited. No, of course not. No, I was saying that Bibi Netanyahu said it was shameful, and I think you have criticized that stance.
Yeah, criticize a lot of what Bibi Netanyahu says.
Yeah, sure. No, but I'm wondering if, because you say, well, it doesn't matter if you protest or not, because it's just a kind of self-expression. And I think it might be dangerous if the Jewish community and also the non-Jewish pro-Israel community, which where I am part from in Germany, is silent about what's happening in America and in the American-Israeli relationship. If we take resolutions like the recent resolution by the United States Security Council, which is critical of the settlement, but not anti-Israel. I mean, for example, I'm a scholar in jihad and Islamism. I know what hatred of Jews and hatred of Israel really means. If you look at Yusuf al-Qaradawi, for example, at the Muslim Brotherhood, they really want to destroy the state of Israel and kill the Jews.
Right.
But it's not the intention of that resolution. And I think if people forget to distinguish between real anti-Semitism and criticism of a specific policy, I think and being silent is a way of not analyzing this this really strange position by some of the far right to equate more or less a hardcore anti-Semitic jihadist stance to a United Nations Security Council stance. You know what I mean?
Look, to the people on the Israeli right and their supporters in America, there's no difference between the settlements in Israel. If you're trying to drive Jews out of, I don't know, Beit El or Hebron, the next step will be Tel Aviv and Haifa. And many of them, most Orthodox Jews, believe that if Israel gives up the West Bank, God will punish Israel. The settler movement began in 1967, 68, out of a yeshiva in Jerusalem that teaches that God gave us the West Bank in 1967, and God will punish us if we give it away. That's the heart of settler ideology. And there's many people who don't necessarily believe that, but who believe that Israel cannot defend itself if it gives up the West Bank. And so the settlements are important to make sure that Israel doesn't give up the West Bank, because it couldn't defend itself if it gave up that territory. So from that point of view, telling Israel that it has to give up the settlements and get out of the West Bank is essentially working toward Israel's destruction in their minds.
Yeah.
Now, most American Jews in the middle don't want to question what Israel does. They don't live there, as far as they're concerned. They need to support Israel. They need to support the government that the Israeli people elected. That's how they think. I mean, Bibi got 24% of the vote, but most people don't see past that. And the other thing is that most, you know, you look at the public opinion polls and you see 70% of the Jews voted for Hillary, which is much less, by the way, than Al Gore or John Kerry or Bill Clinton got in the Jewish vote. She got a low percentage of the Jewish vote, but never mind that. The most liberal Jews are not very engaged. They go to shul a couple of times a year. They have a Passover Seder. They vaguely follow the news from Israel. You know, there have been surveys that I think is something like 35% of the Jews are against settlements, 25% of the Jews, this is America, are in favor of settlements, and 40% don't know, have no opinion, don't follow it closely enough.
Okay, that's
a plurality.
I see.
And the people who show up at meetings and join organizations and give money to these Jewish organizations tend to be more conservative. They tend to operate out of fear. They're afraid of non-Jews, of the enemies of the Jewish people, and so they need to defend it. If you're not afraid, then you have many more choices of what to do with your time and your money.
Yeah, no, I see. In a new book from 2014, The New American Zionism by Theodore Sassoon, you are quoted, for example, with an interesting statement dealing with a kind of rules in the American Jewish establishment. And you were saying, quote, "These rules were quickly taken up by the Jewish leadership as sacred with writ from Jerusalem." Do you recall this discussion, which is years ago, and what kind of stance does American Jewry today have? Because you just said, and that's a little bit contradictory to the book, The New American Zionism, which is 2 years old by Theodore Sassoon, who says he thinks today we have a much wider audience which is actively participating in pro-Israel advocacy in which way ever, and they are not following in the same way all those big NGOs, including AIPAC or the HAC, and they have a much more open-minded view of Israel, and they are more critical but not anti-Israel in his view. So what is your take on this?
Now, first of all, read me the quote that you had from me again. I missed the first word.
These rules were quickly taken up by the Jewish leadership. It's a kind of he's dealing with a kind of rules taken up by the National Jewish Community Relation Advisory Council and the HAC and other groups, which are kind. It was not rules in a way. Rules are rules, but it was a kind of memo or statement for these big NGOs to say, how do we deal with criticism of Israel?
I see. Okay. Look, I have a more pessimistic view than Ted Sassoon. I don't think that the liberal groups, the left groups, J Street or the various student groups, are particularly large or influential. If there was a majority of American Jews who if the majority of the American Jews were against the Israeli policies and cared, they would join J Street. They haven't.
Yeah.
AIPAC is much, much bigger than J Street. The American Jewish Committee is much, much bigger than J Street. Both of them have enormously more money than J Street. You put J Street, the New Israel Fund, and I don't know, the Peace Now together, and a couple of smaller groups around them, the labor Zionists and so on. It's still not a very big group. They can't – I mean, J Street gets 2,000 people to its convention, and AIPAC gets 18,000 people to its convention.
Yeah.
Mm. So yeah, there are people – there are many people who disagree, and the disagreement, the J Street position, for example, is more visible and more audible and more kind of outspoken.
Yeah.
But it's not changing the world.
Yeah, and you don't think, because as far as I understand, for example, people like Eva Illouz or other op-ed commentators in recent weeks who are really outraged, like from a Jewish journal in Los Angeles, Bob Ashman, you know perhaps, he is definitely outraged, and this is the second biggest, largest Jewish weekly in America. So I think he might have some impact.
He's outraged about what?
Yeah. No, outrage about Trump and about the silence in the American Jewish community, or even the support like Jews for Trump and other movements which are already existing on Facebook or social media. The point is, don't you think if it's really an earthquake, I mean, usually people have to react in one way or another. If they are not directly involved, if you're in an earthquake, usually you are a target. So it's an intellectual or anti-intellectual earthquake. So you have to take some measures to stop this or to change the direction or whatever. So that's my question. If it's really an earthquake.
All of these organizations, are tax deductible. Donations, you can make a donation and write it off your taxes. And the rules for tax-deductible organizations are that they cannot come out for or against political candidates. So, and there has also been a change since the 90s. Essentially, Newt Gingrich introduced a new type of politics into Washington where you never agree to be outvoted. You never agree to be outvoted. The other side is not wrong. It's evil. Compromise with evil is evil. And that infected the Jewish community almost immediately, so that Republicans, who are a small percentage of the Jewish community, make threats with their donations to the organizations. They say, change this or keep away from that. Be silent or you lose my money. And you know, it's millions and millions of dollars, because the Jewish Republicans tend also to be rich, except for the Orthodox, who are not involved anyway. So there's been the tax deduction way back in the 1950s and even the 60s. These organizations were active in civil rights, in opposing public policy, and working with other groups to change public policy on American issues. Now they hardly do that. Most Jews don't care what the Jewish community says. They don't pay any attention to it, to these organizations.
Yeah.
The membership in these organizations all put together is a small percentage of the Jews. It's like 20%.
Yeah.
Even in a synagogue, when the rabbi speaks out in a sermon or joins a coalition in his city protesting what the mayor did, what the president did, you get donors to the synagogue saying, all right, I'm quitting. I'm leaving and I'm taking my money.
There was a
bar mitzvah, bat mitzvah in Miami last year, and the mother of the girl who was being bat mitzvah was best friends with Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who was the congresswoman in the next district over from this synagogue. So they invited Debbie Wasserman Schultz to come and speak at Friday night services at the bat mitzvah. And the biggest donor to the synagogue said, if you do that, if she speaks here, I'm quitting. So they canceled her speech the day before. Members of the synagogue would have been very happy to hear her, but one person wasn't, and he was threatening $1 million. And so they changed it. They kicked her out.
Yeah, so, that's a sad story. I mean, money rules the world. Don't you think there is a kind of grassroots, as you remember perhaps your own student times? I mean, when you have your Radical Zionist Alliance, that wasn't a tax-exempt NGO with millions of dollars, right? So perhaps Rafa is a smaller group, and if many of these smaller groups, not only Jewish but also non-Jewish groups, who are involved in liberal issues, that is one of what I'm most astonished that many mainstream and in the left, they are not even scared about the anti-liberalism or the religious extremism by some of the people surrounded by Trump, including the new ambassador, American ambassador to Israel, which you have covered very well, I think, very interesting.
There's been a lot of reaction to the ambassador.
Yeah.
There are groups planning street demonstrations against Trump. The left-wing groups, the newer groups, the millennial groups, modern-day equivalents of the Radical Zionist Alliance, you might say. Trying to think of who. I get emails almost every day from groups that are – there's a whole group that is planning to protest – the rabbi in Los Angeles from the Simon Wiesenthal Center,
yeah.
Rabbi
Meyer,
mm-hmm. who's speaking at the inauguration. So there's a whole protest being organized. It hasn't happened yet because they're trying to figure out exactly what they want to say to him. So, yeah, there's plenty of things going on, but the big organizations, their job is to get along with the administration.
Yeah.
Their job is also to get things done.
Absolutely. But what I think is new, that there might be a real divide in America between those who are siding with Trump, and then they believe only those who are siding with Trump are in the real pro-Israel camp. And that's obviously not true. I mean, perhaps yeah. even the opposite. But that is how it's seen by many in the field. And that might be a question for you, which you might be able to answer. And that's anti-Semitism, because you also dealt with anti-Semitism, which is my field of excellence. And I realize, after many years of studying anti-Semitism in all its forms,
yeah.
that many people who are in that field, I tell you, one of the biggest gatherings of that kind is the Global Forum for Combating Anti-Semitism, which is held every
yeah.
2 years at the Foreign Ministry in Israel. And at some point I realized that many of the people who are involved there are always conservative or even right of conservative, far right, okay?
Right.
Which at some point I realized because there were never ever discussions about mistakes or misconceptions of some sorts of Israel, which might even be anti-Zionist in effect, for example, if we talk about the one-state solution, which it's amazing that those people who are pro-settler, and we had in German TV, we had some settlers saying we are hoping to Israel to annex the entire West Bank. And that's
right.
the one-state solution, which the jihadists and the far left, like Judith Butler, have always
right.
been working on. So
right.
I was wondering if you could tell me why you think that so many people in the field of research and activism against anti-Semitism are not left. This but rather on the right.
Well, part of it goes back to what I was saying before. There's been more and more of a separation, so that more and more the profession of working on and studying Jewish issues has become a province of the right. There are many left-wing or liberal scholars studying Jewish issues, but very often they're studying the issues between the Jews.
Mm-hmm.
The treatment of Jewish women, the treatment of Jewish gay people, the treatment of Jewish non-white people. They take the questions that the American left asks, which
yeah.
are the treatment of minorities, and they plant it inside the Jewish community, and that becomes their field of research. Now, I do a lot of that also, but it's not – it means that generally speaking, I mean, it's the same thing with American newspapers. The liberal newspapers look at what one group of Americans is doing to another group of Americans, and the conservative newspapers look at what foreign countries are doing to America.
Okay.
So that the study of anti-Semitism almost becomes a right-wing thing. There was a center at Yale, I believe it was, that was going to be a center for the study of anti-Semitism, and it got shut down by the university because it became very quickly a center for the defense of Israeli policy.
Oh, that's interesting that you mentioned this, because I was among the first postdocs at that center, which that was that was in 2008. That was the Yale Initiative for the Interdisciplinary Study of Anti-Semitism. You are right, I think, that it might be perceived by some as a pure pro-Israel advocacy institution, but still there have been
not
also
pure. Also doesn't matter. Also doesn't matter. It wasn't pure pro-Israel, but that was a major part of it.
Yeah.
In other words, a lot of the idea that opposing Israel is anti-Semitic, which is a basic principle of the right. and is generally accepted by a lot of the center also. Israel is the Jews' only state, and therefore saying that the Jews don't have a right to have a state in Israel is saying that the Jews are bad or different. So it's anti-Semitic. And it's...
okay, I mean, that's right, in my view. I mean, opposing the state itself.
It's as though there were no Palestinians.
Yeah, I mean, that's another topic. But would you say that opposing the Jewish state as such is not anti-Semitic? Or is just a few among others? I mean, we are not talking about the current government.
There are many people who are anti-Semitic who oppose the Jewish state. But there are also loyal Jews who oppose the Jewish state. There are people who are not anti-Semitic who oppose the Jewish state because they they consider Jews to be a religion and states shouldn't be based on religion.
Yeah, of course, of course.
There's all sorts of reasons to oppose the Jewish state. One of the problems is that, especially in the Muslim world, the Jewish state has become sort of the personification of the Jewish people. So they will bomb a synagogue in Los Angeles or Berlin because they want to punish Israel. So it's anti-Semitic in the sense that it's hating Jews and attacking them. But I think anti-Semitism is hating Jews for no reason or an imaginary reason. Mm-hmm. If you're mad at the Jews, if you're angry at the Jews because of something the Jews actually did, is that it's not prejudice.
Yeah.
If you hate America because America invaded Iraq, is that prejudice against America or is it anger over a policy?
Yeah, sure. I know what you mean. No.
I saw in 2003, in December, I think, of 2000 or November, after the Iraq War, at the end of 2003, I saw. Who was the foreign minister of Germany who was from the Green Party?
Yeah, Joschka Fischer.
Joschka Fischer was being interviewed on American television. And the interviewer said, "Why do you hate America?" And Joschka Fischer said, "I don't hate America. I love America. I grew up on Bob Dylan. I like American culture. I love Hollywood movies. I love the American people. It's the government and its policies that I don't like."
Sure, yes. Yeah.
And the same thing should happen in the Jewish community. So the problem is, if you don't like what the Jewish people are doing, the organized Jewish community stands up automatically in defense of Israel. So if you are willing to bomb a bus in Haifa in order to weaken the occupation, why would you not bomb a synagogue in Berlin? You're also attacking the civilian rear guard, home guard, home front of the Jewish state and its allies. But it's is it anti-Semitism or is it a terrorist attack against Israel? Or are they the same thing?
Yeah, I mean that's related, I think. I mean, today's anti-Semitism is, of course, closely related internationally to hostility to the Jewish state as such.
Right.
You may not even say Israel, because some people frame Israel as a possible one state, so and then that would be fine. Many Palestinian activists in Germany or in Europe in general, they want one state. So, and also in America, some of the academics are favoring a one state. And I also always answer with one of the most famous German Zionists ever, Gershom Scholem, who was at some point, and I did a book on this, Critical Theory and Israel, in German language.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and Gershom Scholem, of course, was Brit Shalomi. He was in the 20s and early 30s. He was in favor of a B-national state. But then he realized it after 1936, when he, as a professor, as an intellectual, was fighting the Arabs on the top roofs of Jerusalem with a gun in his hand at night, which was a scary thing and was not fun at all. So he's describing this. So he became what we call political Zionist. So he was a kind of cultural Zionist before, when he made Aliyah in 1923 and supporting a B-national solution, because he was thinking, well, it's a big land, big enough for two people. But he realized the other side, which means the Palestinians, or what at that time it was course not Palestinians, but Arabs, because of course at that time the Jews themselves were called Palestinians as well, as right. you know. So it was the Arabs or Muslims, and he realized with despair, he was not happy about it, but he realized it might be better to have a separation. And still, this separation, as he himself realized in 1948, included some 20% Arabs in Israel until today. It's mm-hmm. amazing. It's the same percentage, actually. From 1948 to 2017, we have something like 20% uh-huh. Arabs or Palestinians, as we call them today, uh-huh. in Israel. So it's the same percentage, uh-huh. which is actually amazing if you see if you would see any European country having 20% Arabs or Muslims. Mm-hmm. I mean, none of these European countries would survive as a democracy. There would be so many fascist groups, Germany, at the forefront, or the Netherlands, or Hungary, it's unimaginable. So Israel is a democracy, including 20% Palestinians. So those people who say they're against Israel have to say that they are also against a state where 20% of the population is Arab, actually. With the same rights, more or less. We know that it's not exactly the same rights, but in theory, it should be, and it would be in the future. So therefore, I think, yeah, hostility to Israel as a Jewish state is a form of anti-Semitism, as I explained.
Okay, I understand what you're saying. I disagree with some of your facts, but I also disagree with your conclusion. To begin with, if the Arabs that are the Muslims that are coming into Germany were living in their own villages, speaking their own language, and had a separate society along within Germany and alongside it, I think there would be less opposition. If that was the assumption, if the assumption was there can be a second society in Germany that lives among us and alongside us but is not part of us, so we don't have to change how we behave. They're not telling us how we should behave. And besides which, they're scared to death of us. But if you welcome them in as equal partners, then they feel free to try and influence German society, or look at what happened in Cologne last year. Is it Cologne?
Yes. Yeah, it was Cologne. Yeah.
Hamburg, New Year's
yeah.
Eve.
Yeah.
And it happened in many cities. It's a real clash of cultures. In Israel, you don't have the clash of cultures because there's no attempt to mix the cultures.
That's right, but that is, of course, in my view, a very dangerous idea. That is what we call in political science ethno-pluralism. That is a far-right, right-wing extremist ideology developed by someone I did a PhD on. His name is Henning Eichberg. He did develop this concept in the 70s, and he was educated, actually, by a former SS man, so he's definitely a Nazi ideologue. I have difficulties with this kind of homogeneous society, and I always say, and that is important to face and to mention, that Israel is definitely an exception. It's a specific case where universalism can be rejected for a particular case, which is the Zionist or Jewish case. But I would definitely rule out any kind of possibility that any European or Western society, let alone the rest of the world, can mm-hmm. exist as democracy with separated units. That is not possible. I mean, then you have Sharia law all over these small communities with men having several women or punishing them if they drink alcohol or go to sex clubs and all these things. And that's not fun. That's not possible. That's not democracy. It's German or European style.
Well, it's democracy in Israel.
Yeah, that is the Middle East. And therefore, I would say, that's a difference, and it's a kind of miracle or astonishing way that Israel exists as a democracy. In 70 years, we're surrounded by dictatorships or non-democratic societies, but I would not say that Europe should take Israel as a symbol or as a proof that societies only can survive if they are homogeneous societies. That means you have Hamburg, which is reserved for the red-haired. Then you have Cologne, which is reserved at large parts to the Muslim community or to the Arabs. Then you have Munich to the Bavarians and to no one else. I mean, that's not really democracy. I mean, at least it doesn't work in Germany or Europe. In France, you already have these kind of tendencies. You have what they call themselves ghettos, or that means a ghettoization, which is, of course, a strange term, because I would not use it as a term, because that is reminding to Nazi Germany. But still, you have, let's say, suburban areas highly represented by Muslims, mostly from North Africa, like Morocco, Algeria, Tunisia. So they have 90% or more living in these areas. So there's a society in the society, but you see what happens in France. There is not a really integrated society. They have a very bad democratic value system in these communities. They don't share the French universal approach. And so
I think... Look, in the United States, segregation by race was outlawed 50 years ago, but it's still a very segregated country. And the United States is supposed to be one of the great democracies. It's a very, very complicated issue, this issue of racial and ethnic separation, unification, integration, segregation. I don't think anyone has a clear answer. But I think a lot of people think they have a clear answer.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, but Haifa, you mentioned Haifa, and I just want to come back to Haifa, because Haifa might be an example that segregation is not the answer, but rather inclusion. Or because if you go to Haifa University, where I have been last year, and I'm currently translating a book from Haifa University professors, so on about Israel, the Israeli nation state, so by Fania Ostsalzberger. And so if you go to Haifa University, you see at least 20, if not 30% of Palestinian or Arab students. So they are not separated. I mean, they are joining the Jewish University of Haifa, if you may call it Jewish University of Haifa, because it's part of the Jewish state of Israel, and it's a major university. But obviously, democracy works in a kind of, it's not that
Let's
they are...
Say this. It's not a Jewish university, but it is a Zionist university.
Yeah, that's better. Okay, that's for sure. Yeah, yeah, right. But would you agree that it might be a kind of symbol that this 80% Jewish population and 20% Muslim or Arab population in Israel work very well based, for example, take Haifa University as an example? I mean, isn't this the kind of, would that not be a good solution if the entire society would work like this, collaboration and not rather conflict and tension?
You have in the villages a more conservative population. Look, you were talking before about if you had these separate societies in Germany, then they would impose Sharia law and punish women and so on. In Israel, that doesn't happen because young people who don't agree with the Sharia law, the strict conservatism, can go live in Haifa or Shfaram. There's various places where there's an escape valve. They cannot impose on their young people because the society is open and there are places for young Arabs to go and live and integrate into Israeli society. But there are also pockets of Jewish society that don't allow integration, the entire ultra-Orthodox community, the Haredim.
Yeah, sure.
And I mean, even the fact that, you know, there are fights over whether an Arab from Nazareth can go to Nazareth Elite and live. It's a big fight.
I know.
But no place is perfect. It's every place on earth is an experiment, a project I forget the word now. An experiment that's in still continuing.
Yeah.
There are no answers.
I mean, at least for Germany and France, because they also have a kind of theorist. His name is Alain de Benoist. He's a kind of friend or former colleague of this Mr. Eichberg. I did my PhD on a couple of years ago. Yeah. And they developed this concept based on their own idea of a homogeneous, of course, Aryan society. And they realized at some point in the late 60s and early 70s, they realized it's not easy to have something like a genocide or like an expulsion of millions of people, but perhaps it might be possible to say we can start having specific areas in Europe dedicated for a specific group of people. So you have parts of Cologne just for the Arabs and Muslims, or parts of Hamburg for these kind of people. And the point is that they want, and that is of course a German, traditional German National Socialist racist thinking, they want to have a pure Aryan entity in most parts of the country. They realized at some point that it won't be possible to have 100% Aryan Germans, despite the fact that they killed almost all Jews. But they realized there are so many millions of mostly Turkish people and Arab people came to Germany in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, and now they have even a second, third generation. It's difficult to expel all these people. So now they say, well, if we separate, that might be a good solution. I mean, and still we have today in Germany, we're talking about 2017, we still have groups, neo-Nazi groups, who still have flyers and posters saying, we love Africa, or we love Africans, but we love them in Togo or Cameroon. You know what I mean? I mean, I even came across in recent weeks some neo-Nazi pages in America who are saying, we love Israel. Because then we can get rid of all the Jews. They want the Jews of America to Israel.
No. The far right in America loves Israel because it admires what Israel has done. They're not trying to get – most of the far right doesn't – they're not trying to get rid of the Jews.
I mean, those pages I have seen was not far right, were really neo-Nazis. So, and those neo-Nazis
okay, so
from
the neo-Nazis don't like the Jews, but there's many of their allies. It's a much larger movement, what they call the alt-right.
Yeah.
The group that's got a the Stephen Bannon and his people. They don't talk mostly. They don't talk about Jews. But they do love Israel, not because it's a place to dump the Jews. But because it's, I mean, they may not like the Jews. They know that, just like you said, it's impractical to expel 5 or 6 million people who are so integrated into American society. But they like Israel because it's fighting Muslims, because it has shown a way to separate within its own society. So it's more pro-Israel than anti-Jewish. Israel has become a symbol of the Western society and its fight against the dark peoples of the world.
Yeah.
To them.
Mm. Yeah.
And again, there are people I know, people that I know and admire, and I like, who don't think there should be they in favor of a one-state solution. Because of the Palestinian rights, because of the nature, because of their vision of integrated societies. They would like Israel to be like Germany or France or what America was supposed to be.
Yeah, but but then there will be...
They're American... Sorry?
Yeah. No, I know, but those people who are in a positive way, as they think of themselves, promoting a one-state solution, they would still have to acknowledge or to say that will be the end of Jewish sovereignty. I mean, it would be the end that Jews can decide what kind of policy they want to impose or not, which is the case in Israel. And so you never know, and taking the history mainly of, in this case, Arab or Muslim anti-Semitism, it's unlikely that this will stop in a few days, months, or even years or decades. So, I mean, that was one of the things even someone like Gershom Scholem realized in 1936, in my view, And he was definitely very liberal. He was an anarchist. He was a far left person, but he realized that if the other side is not really willing to accept the existence of Jews in that country, and if they would exist, accept the existence of Jews, then they would just accept this under the option that a one-state solution might result in the domination of the Jews by the Arabs and Muslims. He realized this and wanted a strong Jewish majority. So I understand this, and I think this is still the case.
All right.
No, I mean, you want to add something? Yeah, sure. Yeah.
I mean, are we being taped or something?
Yes.
Okay. I still think anti-Semitism is changing. It is more and more a function of opposition to things that the Jews actually do, rather than simply hatred of some mythical creature that they've created and planted on the Jews. Medieval European anti-Semitism was hatred of the Jews simply because they're Jews.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Simply because they don't want to be part of, they don't accept Jesus,
mm-hmm.
or they killed Jesus.
Yes, mm-hmm. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
And now Muslim anti-Semitism is mainly hatred of these people who came in and set up a foreign state in the middle of the Muslim world.
In addition to some of the traditional Muslims, before
1900, before 1880, Muslim anti-Semitism was minuscule. It was nothing compared to European anti-Semitism. When you talk about the history of Muslim anti-Semitism or Arab anti-Semitism, Jews were a tolerated minority. They were second-class citizens, but that's all they were.
Yeah, yeah.
They weren't hated or driven out. In Europe, one country after another massacred Jews, expelled Jews, and then ultimately tried to kill all the Jews. Nothing
yes.
like that ever happened in the Muslim world. It's after after 1880 or 1917, you can pick the beginning of Zionism wherever you want. But since then, there has been a growing hostility toward these people who came in. And, you know, when Europeans created this demonic image of the Jew, who's a superhuman and threatens us, 1948 created a demonic image of the Jew because 600,000 people beat the entire Muslim world or the entire Arab world and have continued to do it time after time.
Yeah.
So, you know, on the one hand, it's possible that if there were one state, the Muslim complaint against the Jews would begin to go away. You know, the Arab Peace Initiative was accepted by the Organization of Islamic Cooperation. That's the entire Muslim world. They would not make all of the radicals in the Muslim world, the jihadists, disappear. But part of that negotiation would have to be, all right, we are accepting a Palestinian state on the 67 borders, and you are accepting that the conflict is over, and therefore you must stop the funding of these anti-Semites on American campuses and European campuses. That's got to be over too.
Yeah.
We can't change the minds of all of the young left-wing or extreme right-wing Muslims in Europe or even in Baghdad or Damascus. The jihadists who will continue killing Jews are also killing Arabs.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
So that's not going to go away. But if the mainstream of the Muslim world accepts the deal that Israel accepts with the Palestinians, then a lot, if they are sincere about what they voted on, which is the Arab Peace Initiative,
mm-hmm.
which I believe they are, then it proves my point that a lot of the attacks on Jews today are attacks on surrogates for Israel. It's a disagreement with what Israel did to the Palestinians. And if the Arab world accepts, okay, we give up, you have a Jewish state.
Yeah.
Finished.
Yeah.
then much of what we now call anti-Semitism will decline, because it was and is based on our hatred of what European Jews did in the Middle East. And if they come to accept it, but there's no sign of Israel accepting it at this point.
Yeah.
Israel refuses to accept that deal. They don't want the 67 borders. The current government doesn't want a two-state solution at all. So they are continuing the situation that results in hostility toward Jews. Now, hatred is something else. There is hostility toward Jews among people who don't like, you know, there's a William F. Buckley. You know who he is?
Yes.
Yes, the leader of kind of the new right in American politics. He expelled anti-Semites from his publication and from the organizations he had influence over. He made anti-Semitism a no-no in American conservatism for the first time, beginning in the 50s, and then in 1991 or 92, I think, he wrote about a special issue of the National Review on anti-Semitism and how it continues to be a problem. And he expelled Joseph Sobran, who was one of his long-term closest allies, because Sobran continually wrote attacks on Jews. So I called Sobran and I talked to him at great length. He said, "I don't hate Jews. I don't like what the Jewish community is doing to America. The Jewish community favors abortion rights. The Jewish community works for integration. The Jewish community works for the removal of prayer from public schools. I don't like the agenda of the Jewish community. So I am against the Jews as an entity. I don't hate Jews as individuals. I believe they should have full rights as Americans, but I don't agree with the agenda of the Jewish community. Does that make me an anti-Semite? Buckley thinks it does, because I am against the Jewish community. I call myself a counter-Semite. I am against what the Jewish community is trying to do. It makes Jews dislike me, but I don't hate them. I disagree with them as an entity, as a corporate. Now, Jews don't recognize themselves in the diaspora as a corporate entity that has an agenda.
Of course,
that's unrealistic.
Of course, I mean, the Jewish community is not that Jewish community. It's a very diverse group of people, which has definitely not one single opinion on one single topic. So they have different opinions.
But it does. 90% of the Jews in America are in favor of abortion rights.
Yeah. Okay. That's
90%, 85 or 90% are in favor of outlawing prayer in public schools. And the organizations that they support lobby and work for these policies successfully. So the Jews as individuals, Americans as individuals are diverse, but the American government takes taxes from them and does things with them. So if you don't like what America is doing in the world, do you hate Americans? Not necessarily, but it looks like that to a lot of Americans, because you don't like what America is doing.
Of course. No, I get your argument. I mean, if you are
so
full of hatred.
There is such a thing as the Jews as a corporate entity, and many Jews disagree with it, but they allow it to continue, and they continue contributing money to it, to support it.
Yeah, yeah.
And on the main agenda of the organized Jewish community, there isn't that much diversity. On the liberal policies of gender rights, of abortion rights, of gay rights, which Jews overwhelmingly support.
No, that's right. But when it comes to
internationalism, of strong foreign aid, of support for Israel. So many people in America don't like all that.
No, but when it comes to Trump, obviously we have, as we mentioned at the beginning of this interview, an earthquake. So there is definitely a divide in American Jewry, I think, over Trump, and that's not a 90% pro or contra. It's rather a 70-30 margin, that would lead us to perhaps several interviews in the years to come about these topics, because Trump will start in 2 weeks. Thank you very much for joining us and for your very interesting comments. And have a good day. And
thank
I look
you
forward
for
to reading your
Anytime
next
you
pieces.
Want to call back, it's interesting.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay, have a good day, JJ.
Okay.
Bye-bye.